Thank you for listening to Mormon Sex Info. This episode is an archived episode and is only now becoming publicly available. Mormon Sex Info relies on contributions. To contribute, please visit mormonsex.info. And now, please enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Mormon Sex Info. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and this will be part three of the Canon interview. Thank you for listening.
So two things kind of really triggered this, my move towards, I have to figure out how to do this. The first was when I got called in to meet with the bishop, or it was to renew our temple recommends. Following my policy, I told him, hey, I have a porn problem and have for most of my life. And he asked me if I had told Mitzi, and I said no. And he recommended that I tell her and counseled that he did not believe I would ever be able to put this behind me and move on from it without telling my wife. And that knowing her, she would probably be very understanding. And, you know, he worked with a guy one time who, you know, had the same problem, and he told his wife, and they went on this long walk and talked about it, and, you know, and he was finally able to put it behind him. And I thought that sounded wonderful for that guy, but I wondered how much follow-up the bishop had done with him, and how long that lasted. Because for me, I was so discouraged on the notion that this was ever going to go away completely, because I had gone for so long and been so hopeful and then had failed so many times that I just kind of was reaching the conclusion, this is going to be a part of my life. How can I make it so that it has the least negative impact possible? And so I responded to him and I said, I will do what you tell me to do, but I think that is a very bad idea. And I don't think that's going to help anybody. And I said, this is a problem I haven't been able to solve. And I've been working on it for 15, you know, almost 20 years. And telling her, she's totally unprepared and unequipped to deal with this. You know, what is that going to do? That's going to burden her with this problem I haven't been able to fix for most of my life, and she has no control over it, and she's going to feel terrible, and she's going to want to try and help and fix and stuff like that, but it's not her problem, and she has no control over it, and she is going to get all of the baggage and have none of the control. I don't think that's a good idea at all. Thankfully, he held back and said, okay, well, you know, why don't you pray about it and think about it, and you know, and let's keep in touch. So I didn't say anything at that point, but at the second thing that happened around that time was, you know, we had kids, and our first is a boy, and he was getting a little bit older, you know, 2, 3, 4 years old, and he was showing so many just personality traits and things like that that were so much like me. And that terrified me because I thought, my son is going to have a porn problem because I have a porn problem and I grew up in the days of dial-up modems, you know, and before cell phones were invented. And there's no way he's going to be able to avoid it. And if he's anything like me, it's going to become a part of his life. And if I don't do something to solve this problem, I'm going to possibly have to watch him get divorced, watch his wife divorce him when she finds out he has a porn problem, and have everybody be on her side and sympathizing and stuff like that. Or even worse, he might not even get to that point. If he feels about porn the way I did growing up, he may end up killing himself before he ever gets to that point. and I may end up burying my own child over this. And I just decided that was not an acceptable option. And I decided everything I've heard from the church and other people in my life has not helped me at all. And so I have to start from scratch and figure out how to make this work. How to make this work for me, how to make this work for a marriage, and how to pass on a better model to my children so my kids, you know, don't end up getting divorced or killing themselves over this issue the way I almost did. That was a big turning point, and I just started researching. I started a Mormon sexuality blog where I would review peer-reviewed research articles and summarize them and kind of break them down into layman's terms, which I would write kind of editorial essays and stuff like that up there. And I would talk to Mitzi about it. And that was part of the process of just giving her the tools to, you know, just the language, the intellectual framework, the ideas to deal with this problem when I finally came out to her with it. And so that was a several year process as well, that we just started talking about this stuff. It was easy to find an excuse to cover it up because we knew so many people who were going through this.
Okay, I was going to ask that. How did you do a porn blog without...
I was totally clueless about it because there were enough people close to us that he could just use someone else as an example.
Yeah. And that was really great because I could field ideas to her and be like, you know, so-and-so and that they're doing this and I don't really agree with that or whatever. Or like, I think maybe this would be a better way, and then could get her reaction on that and then note that for, okay, so when I come out to her eventually, this is kind of what she thinks about this.
And Scott was always, you know, sympathetic to the porn user, obviously. And so he would, when I would hear about a couple getting divorced over porn or something, he would always kind of talk to me about that and make me more sympathetic to the porn user too. Right. And so I wasn't so like, oh, like it's his fault and he's the worst and right. Ugh. So just years and years of kind of softening the blow, I guess.
Yeah, and it's not like I was trying to say it wasn't bad or anything like that. I was just trying to turn them into people instead of condition. This person has failed their moral condition, and that's all that matters. They're no longer a person. You know, they no longer have, you know, talents or, you know, quirks or personality or anything like that. They are just, you know, the porn addict who has broken the tender hearts of their wives and children. And of course, she's going to divorce him. It just seemed like so many people were operating on the given assumption that if you are a Mormon woman and you discover or he confesses a porn problem, you are probably going to get divorced. And you probably should get divorced. And that just seemed so stupid to me and so reductive and simplistic. What I would do with Mitzi is I would try to complicate things a bit. One of the big kind of ideas that really helped us look at this differently was, what are you going to do when the man in that equation is your son? And it's your son coming to you saying, my wife is going to divorce me and take the kids because I have a porn problem. Are you going to feel the same way? Are you going to just automatically side with your daughter-in-law when she's saying that, of course, she's divorcing your son? He has a porn problem.
People getting completely defined by this one particular problem. So, yeah. You know, I, for example, when I'm working with couples around this issue, I'll say, well, so tell me about the rest of your marriage. Yeah, you're having this, you know, obviously this issue with this behavior, but
how are you doing with parenting? Oh, great. You know, how are you doing with financial decisions? Oh, we're really good. You know, how are you doing with emotional connection? Oh, we're like best friends. But all of that gets almost wiped away.
Yep.
Because this one problem now trumps it. It defines the entire marriage. And I think we've kind of set it up that way. I don't necessarily blame the wife for going there because that's kind of how we've set it up.
Yeah, that's her model.
And granted, we're talking about this from a, you know, the male being the porn user. That's not always the case.
No, and that was, you know, an article I wrote on my blog, and it was actually an article from a BYU publication. I don't know if it was a student publication or what, but it was a fantastic article called Porn and Shame at BYU, and it's no longer available. I don't know what happened to it, but I copied most of it to my blog. I quoted from it extensively because it interviewed two guys and two women who were BYU students who were struggling with pornography. And it was so helpful to hear the female side of this because they just talked about like, this is seen as such a male problem that I'm terrified to tell anybody about it because I am going to be seen as even more deviant and perverse and grotesque than the guys are. Because, yeah, it's gross that guys do this, but it's kind of expected. You know,
we've always told men they're gross.
Yeah. Yeah. And then for a woman to come forward and say, oh, I do this too, that's just inconceivable for people. To even think like, I mean, how are they going to respond to that other than that's just even more horrible than for men. And it was a really great voice to have. And it's a shame that article's not available anymore because it was really good. So I started doing all this research and writing all this stuff, and I just used trying to put my psychology degree to work, which I'd never done in my employment.
he discovered Mormon Stories, which I'd never heard of, and he started having me listen to podcasts, and he kind of had to bribe me first to do it because I didn't want to do it. I'm just so resistant to everything with this stuff, but
because it's fringe and, you know, kind of.
Yeah, stuff. I mean, I never heard of Mormon Stories, but I remember when the intro and it said, when John Lynn would say, Mormons like you, and that made me so uncomfortable. I'm like, what does that mean? Like, I did not like this. Anyway, but the first few episodes was the ones that you and Jennifer and John Lynn like talking about better sex in your Mormon marriage. I listened to that one, and there's another one on pornography addiction that he had me listen to. And then I just really started getting into it, and I started listening to anything that you or Jennifer said. I listened to all of your podcasts over and over, and I would read your blogs and everything. That kind of got me started.
Which was so helpful. And I think when, for so many people, when, you know, a porn issue is discovered or disclosed, they just don't have the resources, the knowledge base, anything to work through this in any way. And all they see around them is people getting divorced over it. And so it almost seems like becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And it's so tragic because it's so unnecessary. People just don't know anything different. There's no, you know, it's like, I love the Ash conformity experiments, you know, the famous psychology experiments where, you know, people are looking at three different lines and then shown a fourth line and they have to say which one match up. And then they change it so that all of the people start giving the wrong answer and the same wrong answer. And then they see what the subject does. And if they conform, even though they know it's obviously the wrong answer, when everyone is in unison giving the wrong answer, you know, the rate of conformity is very high. Even though the you know, the subjects would kind of shake their head or roll their eyes sometimes that they knew they were giving the wrong answer, but they would give it anyway because the social pressure was so great. And then you blow that out to Mormon culture and your ward and your family and stuff like that, and that pressure to handle this or assign it a certain meaning, even if it's really unhelpful and unhealthy and destructive to your life and your family's life. If there aren't any alternatives, that's probably what you're going to do. And so that's why I just decided I have to do something different. I still felt like, okay, porn is wrong and it's bad, and I wish I didn't have to, you know, do it, and wish it wasn't a part of my life, would stop if I could. And I'm just kind of resigned to the fact that I'm not going to be able to do that. And this is just something I'm going to have to live with somehow. Then, I had my faith crisis that kicked off when, the church released the Race and the Priesthood essay. That's something that had bothered me most of my life in, you know, from when I became aware of it. Reading this essay, you know, where the church basically disavows everything that was said by church leaders previously, and it condemns all racism, past and present, and just this complete reversal. Around the same time that this essay came out, the church seemed like in general conference was on a big kick where every other talk they were, you know, sharing the quote, which I think is Wilford Woodruff quote, where it says, you know, the prophet will not be allowed to lead the church astray. And if he does, he will be removed from his office and replaced. People were just saying that all over the place, you know, follow the prophet, the prophet will never lead the church astray. And then here's this essay that I'm reading, and it's saying, oh, actually, most of the prophets led the church astray on a pretty big issue for about 100 years or more. And that was just earth-shattering for me. And immediately I thought, what if they're wrong about this sin next to murder stuff? You know, which I knew intellectually they were wrong about, because like we talked about, sexual sin or just sexual behavior is a spectrum. Goes from, you know, a kid having a crush on a girl and feelings for her in school or something like that, to child rapists and stuff like that. It's like, those are not the same thing. And yet the church doesn't clarify any of that. And so I thought to myself, I'm like, what if they're wrong about this? What if me looking at porn doesn't make God hate me? And what if it doesn't make me a terrible person? And what if God has actually loved me all this time? And so shortly after that, I had an experience where whenever I would backslide, I would always pray after, even though I hated doing it, just because I felt like, you know, if I didn't pray when I felt like I shouldn't pray, then that was even worse. And so I would just pray and just be, I'm so sorry. Like, I can't believe I did this again, and I'm such a screw up. Please be patient with me. Like, I won't give up. I'll keep trying. I'm just so sorry. And just these real, just sad prayers of remorse and shame and just feeling like such a failure. And so one day, you know, around this time, I backslid or whatever, and I went out and was going to say my regular, I'm sorry, be patient with me, I'm a screw up prayer. And instead, I decided I'm going to ask Heavenly Father what he really thinks about this, and what he thinks about me, and if everything I've believed for all this time is what he actually thinks. And so I knelt down and prayed, and I said, Heavenly Father, does looking at porn make me a bad person? And does looking at porn make you angry with me? And does it make you hate me? And have you hated me and been disappointed with me all these years that I felt like you have? The answer came to me as I've received answers many times before, but it was a still small and emphatic no to all of those questions. And it was a no, and it said, no, I don't feel that way about you. No, this does not make you a bad person. No, I don't hate you. And I've never hated you, and I've never felt that way. You always just believed that I did because of what other people said. And I'm so glad you finally asked me so I could tell you the truth that I love you and I've always loved you and you're okay. And this does not make you a bad person. This struggle with pornography and navigating this relationship with pornography had colored everything in my life from when I was, 13 years old. I didn't go a day without thinking about this and trying to be better and overcome it. And now I had this experience and this conversation with God. And first I just felt this tremendous relief and peace and love. And then almost immediately I felt this intense anger toward the church and towards all those people who had told me that looking at porn would turn me into a serial killer. And I believed them. And I thought I was turning into a serial killer, and I almost killed myself. And I stood up in my living room, and I thought to myself, I've almost killed myself over this stuff, and it was all a bunch of bull. And it made so much sense to me. I'm like, of course it was bull. Like, I am not a bad person. I do not treat my wife badly. Like, I do not do any of these things that everyone always told me porn would do to me. And I'm like, all of this pain and everything is because of the church and because what I believed. Like, my pain and suffering and all of the bad stuff that has come from this struggle with pornography had almost nothing to do with the pornography and everything to do with the church and what I had been taught to believe about it and about myself. It was a couple of nights later, but I broke down sobbing in bed with Mitzi, and I very rarely cry. And I just broke down sobbing, and she asked why. And all I said at that time was, I feel like God doesn't hate me for the first time in my life. And I just bawled. Yeah. 6 months later, I felt like we were at the point when I could tell her that I had a relationship with pornography and probably would for the rest of my life, maybe.
Well, tell her in that 6 months you kind of decided to give yourself permission to, instead of being like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that you're just going to accept it, incorporate it,
oh, yeah,
try to balance it.
Yeah, so after that experience, I decided, okay, I'm not going to try and fight this anymore. I'm just going to give myself permission to watch all the porn I want and see what happens and see if I become some, lunatic or whatever. And it's like, I'm 33 years old. It's like, I think I'm pretty well established as a person, and I really don't think I'm going to change all that much, even if I watch, all the porn I can stand. And so I just gave myself permission to watch all the porn I wanted. And of course, and it's like, I had a job and I have a family and kids, and it's like, that still wasn't very much. And it's like, and I didn't need very much, but it was just like, let's see what happens. Let's see if what everyone said is true. All the scare stories, all the stuff. Let's see how much of it's true and how much of it is baloney. As soon as I let go of that shame, and it was no longer this taboo and off limits and everything like that, the compulsion went away. You know, like I mentioned before, how there would be times when I would feel almost like my body would become possessed, and I was, you know, I would be walking down the stairs in the night against my own will, almost, and that went away. It became as mundane a part of life as anything else. And nothing happened except for I started to feel a lot better about myself and started to realize that porn is kind of what you make of it, just like most things in life. And I had been making it a huge and terrible thing. And once I stopped treating it that way, it wasn't that anymore.
So Scott finally decides to tell me 6 months after he's done this. And part of the reason is because of our struggle, my struggle in the bedroom. And I'm still 8 years into our marriage and I'm still anorgasmic and all of this stuff. And so he gets me ready one night and he tells me about, I have this relationship with pornography, and he didn't say it quite like that, but anyway, he let me know, and I was so happy that night because I'm like, oh, that's why he was crying in bed 6 months ago, and
that explains so much.
Why he was suicidal. Because I knew he was suicidal at a certain point when he was a freshman in college. I'm like, oh, that explains that. That explains why he would go to bed so many times, like almost every night. Mm-hmm. And he would almost kind of have a panic attack. And I would say, what is wrong with you? And he would say, I just feel like everything in my life is going to disappear. And I would say, what are you talking about? Like, I'm here. Everything's fine. You know, we're good. You know, and so I was so happy the first night because everything made sense. He opened up to me. And then the next day, I just kind of fell apart. And I just couldn't believe like the reality of my life. And I felt like it was such a lie, you know, it just been, who was this person that I'd married? And the heaviness of pornography is so heavy because, you know, I remember going to a Time Out for Women, and I think her name's Jill Manning. This presenter, she's done all this research on porn. She's spoke for an hour about pornography addiction, and it was just the most depressing thing to me. And then another time, we have an addiction recovery couple in our missionary couple in our ward, and we had a combined fifth meeting lesson one time about pornography addiction, and it was awful. I just remember the sister missionary saying, like, they'll look at it once and they're addicted for life. And I just thought, what in the world? Like, everyone's going to see it at least once in this day and age. I just remember leaving feeling depressed and totally hopeless about pornography. This is before I knew anything about Scott. But just the way we talk about pornography in general and just friends getting divorced over it and just other close people. And so Scott tells me this, and I'm just so conflicted for so many different reasons, but I'm just like, he has been trying for 20 years already and he hasn't been successful. And I didn't know what to do about it because porn is so shameful for everyone and for the wife too. And plus, Scott didn't come to me saying, I have a porn problem, please help me. He came to me and said, I have this porn problem, and basically, like, I've accepted it and I'm good to go,
Like, I've had this porn problem most of my life. I've always felt terrible about it, and like God hated me. I prayed about it, and God doesn't hate me for it, and God says I'm okay. And so I'm just going to incorporate it in a balanced way into my life, and I no longer hate myself because of it.
Yeah, and so I just cried like so much, and I was just trying to figure out what in the world to do, because do I try to force him into a recovery program? Do I just divorce him? And he came out to me in August of 2014, and I just remember I spent the entire month reading or listening to everything and mostly non-church things, because the church stuff was so incredibly depressing to me. Because I remember seeing a website that it's called Battleship
Rowboats and Marbles,
and Marbles versus Battleships. And it's this guy who has a blog or something, and he compares his pornography addiction to him being in a rowboat throwing marbles at a battleship. And I'm just like, is there a more depressing model than that? And then another story that I found on some church thing was this married couple, and the couple, he struggled for 30 years of their marriage, and finally after 30 years they'd made it to a point where they were kind of okay, but they compared it to them rowing upstream in separate boats for the rest of their marriage.
Yeah. But rowing in the same direction.
Upstream.
Upstream.
It was, everything was so awful. And I just stopped trying to look at that stuff and tried to read things from like Dr. Ruth and like non-Mormon things about porn and get like a different perspective about it, and just try to think about it in a different way, because the church stuff was so depressing to me. And so I was just going back and forth about trying to decide if I should throw him in rehab or accept him or whatever. And one day after a fight in the morning, he went into our room, and I came in and he was on the ground disassembling our handgun that we had in a safe in our room. And I was like, what are you doing? And he just said, being proactive or something. Mm-hmm. And I just left the room, and I just went in the kitchen, and I was just like, oh my gosh. Like, and then he came back out, and I think I started crying, and I was just like, he is such a wonderful person, and he is trying to kill himself. He's thinking about killing himself. I'm seeing it in front of my eyes. And over porn, and I'm just like, the church is wrong about this. And I wish that was the end of our fights, but it wasn't, because I still battled with myself for months and months of up and down and trying to decide what to do. And I wish that day would have been enough realization for me, but it wasn't. I still had to fight against the model that I was given as the porn wife, you know, like I had to reject the script that I was given. And just, I just feel like Scott and I have just been pioneers with this. Like, I just had to create my own path.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that script a little bit. What are the messages that you get as the wife?
I feel like
an enabler.
Well, I feel like people see me as an enabler because I've allowed you to have this porn relationship. So I'm an enabler. So that's who I am. But I feel like the porn wife is, she's betrayed. Mm-hmm. She's wounded. I mean, what?
She can't trust her husband anymore.
She's a victim. And I hated that I was going to live my life betrayed and as a victim to Scott's choices. That just didn't seem fair. All right, why should I be unhappy for the rest of my life because of this? And so I just feel like Scott had to think about porn differently to survive this life, and I had to think about porn differently to be happy in my marriage. Because do I want to feel betrayed and sad the rest of my marriage, or get divorced and deal with the fallout of divorce with my kids and being a single mom? Like, it's all crap choices. And we just made our own choices that were way better. And it's been so hard because we've kind of come out about this with family and friends and even our ward members. And, you know, we don't have any support from anyone about the choices that we've made surrounding this. But man, I can't even tell you how many times I'm like, we made the right choice for us. And I don't want to speak for anyone else. And I don't want to make porn wives feel bad that I'm trying to diss on them and their reactions. But I just had to reject it. I just can't live my life that way. And
well, and I think a lot of it too is you're given the message that pornography competes with you sexually.
Right.
I think that that's a very common feeling for women. I mean, we're given that message from overall culture anyway, you know, that so much of our value as women is tied to our attractiveness, our sexiness, our sex appeal. You know, I commonly say that both men's and women's magazines have women on them, right? Right. And so women have been objectified a lot in our culture. And so I think porn hits at the base of that for Mormon women, especially impacted by the then even more messages that we get from the church. And if you've been told your whole life that this is something vile and evil and it will destroy your marriage, and, you know, your husband is somebody now that is everything antithesis, right, to everything that's supposed to get you to the celestial kingdom, for example, then of course you're going to have that reaction. And I'm not going to minimize, obviously, the ideal here is for the two of you to have had the skills and know-how of how to sexually contract to begin with. But my experience is that pretty much we all stink at that because nobody has taught us how to do that. And so there is a level of betrayal here. I mean, he is acting sexually in a way that you probably would have wanted to know about, but for a lot of really valid reasons that you've all explained, that honesty was an unsafe place to go.
Yeah.
And even with all this prepping, you know, that you're describing, it was still extremely difficult. It sounds like to hear that, that this was closer to home than you had imagined.
Yep.
So I don't think it's as easy as, oh, it shouldn't be a problem at all, but it definitely should not be, it's the end of our marriage. And there's so much possibility of reframing and understanding sexuality and fantasy and visualization of sex versus relational sex. You know, I mean, there's just so much great research out there to help people understand what this actually means versus what we all think it means.
And for me in our marriage, and that's part of it too, that was different, is that I never felt like Scott made me feel less than. He never made me feel like my body wasn't good enough. You know, like he just didn't do a lot of the stereotypical things that I've heard about. Like he just internalized it all and heaped it all on himself. And he didn't project any anger on me, you know? So yeah, he had this secret from me that he'd hidden from me, but he hadn't done other destructive things really. And so after he told me about the porn, that actually accelerated my own sexual desire, because it wasn't until I saw that the porn is a threat to my marriage that I had enough fire in my belly to be like, okay, I need to work on the bedroom. I need to take it that much more seriously because our marriage is at stake with this. That's just how I felt about it. And then I also felt like, okay, I've been spending my whole marriage trying to manage Scott's sex drive to keep him out of sin, and it didn't work anyway. So I'm like, bag that, and I'm going to think about myself more. And so I just totally stopped thinking about Scott's sex drive at all and just started thinking about my own. And that really accelerated my own progress finally in the bedroom. And I did, like, with time, even though I was really resistant to it, I was just like, I need to try erotica. Because by this point, it'd been 9 years of marriage, anorgasmic. So on the good days when I wasn't trying to throw Scott into rehab, I was open to it. And he'd made me kind of like a PG-13-ish porn site. Like he'd made it special so I wouldn't have to see other things. And that wasn't really my favorite, but we've discovered like erotic stories. And
well, and one of the things that I think was, you mentioned being really helpful with that was even just seeing PG-13 type porn, like the stuff you would see if, you know, just cutting the romance clip scene out of like a PG-13 movie or something like that. And I think that so many people and especially women are so afraid of porn because they have no idea what it actually is. They have no exposure to it. And so it's like the old, you know, Hollywood saying that when you're trying to make a scary movie, that you don't show the monster because what's unseen is so much scarier than what you actually see.
Yeah.
And it's like having no concept of what pornography was seemed like was so much scarier. And after she'd seen even just PG-13 stuff, just kind of having that conceptualization of like, oh, this is
just porn.
This is what it is.
It's not.
It's, I yeah. don't know. And just took away so much of that.
The fear.
And that was really, I think that was a really powerful thing for wow. you in terms of just recontextualizing pornography with more information and more experience and more context, put it in its proper place and assign it its proper, power.
Anytime you see people having sex, it's going to be probably a combination of excitement and embarrassment and, curiosity and holy cow, what am I looking at? Discomfort. And so it is normal to have feelings that are not super comfortable necessarily around those types of visuals. And I think also when we're talking about pornography, we're talking about mainly sexual acts that both or the threesome or whatever you're going to see are somewhat consensually seeming to be done. I mean, there are different levels of pornography that can be problematic and even violent or concerning. That's not what we're talking about, though. The majority of pornography is basic sexual acts conducted by 2 to 3 to 4 people, if you get into some of the polyamory stuff. We forget that, you can watch something as simple as a Disney movie where Cinderella's kissing the prince and there's arousal in that possibly, there's like, oh, this feeling of, how beautiful and how wonderful and how romantic. And you can take that energy and what are you going to do? Like go get a blow up doll of Prince Charming or of Cinderella? Probably not. You're going to take that energy and take it to the relationship you're in. And that's what we find happens with pornography as well. The research has shown that when people either watch it individually or even as a couple, that there is, of course, arousal and there is excitement. And then the energy kind of turns towards the partner. And that's something that we've been lied to, because we say it actually turns you away from your partner.
Yeah, and that was so much my experience was that when I get aroused or like see something or something like that, it's like I want to do something about it with my wife. What was so hard and so frustrating, and why I wanted her to even just try this, because we tried everything on the other side of the line, I felt like, and we still couldn't get that arousal piece. And I was just like, I'm not at all threatened by you, looking at this stuff or whatever. It's like, I actually think it will help because that's what it's designed to do. And I know that if your experience is anything like mine, that energy will be directed towards our relationship. And I'm totally on board with that. That's what I've been wanting for years and years, is to have, my wife having independent, agentic sexual desire that she then brings into our relationship.
And also around the same time, I finally got brave enough to go and make an appointment with the doctor just to see if there was a physical component. Because I had always wondered, but I was kind of too embarrassed to find out. And so Scott and I went in together, and Scott went in to get some Prozac to kind of help his mental state.
Yeah, and so to contextualize this a little bit, because Mitzi talked about walking in and finding me, when I came out to her, like she said, that first day She was so wonderful and supportive and sympathetic and loving and everything like that. And I kind of joke that that's, I call that the 24-hour support period. When you first tell them about it, they're very supportive and wonderful and loving, but then the next day it gets real. It just was such a roller coaster, and I felt so terrible that I had tried to protect my wife from it, and I had tried to fix it, and I had tried to keep it from harming anyone but me. And now I felt like I could bring it out and it would be okay, and I was okay with it. And then seeing how traumatic it was for her, and just the crying and the disorientation and the disillusionment and just the pain that she was feeling. And I just felt like, what have I done? I should have taken this pain with me to the grave, because now I have brought so much pain and suffering to her. And I felt like I wasn't worth it. I got very suicidal again, and I was very desensitized to the idea of my own death by this time. And it really seemed like a viable option, because I was like, okay, I have good life insurance. I just bumped it up. That'll take care of her emotionally and financially and the kids and everything. And the kids are still little, so they won't, you know, maybe they won't remember me that well, and she's, you know, attractive and smart and all these things, and she'll be able to probably find another husband pretty easily who can just slip into my place, and the kids can attach to him, and he'll be the only dad that they've ever known, except for maybe the oldest. I will be gone. My suffering will be over. Her suffering, you know, at least from this, will be able to be resolved, because she'll be able to get a working model husband instead of this defective one that I represent. And everyone will be happy. And that's a better outcome than what we're probably going to get with this. And so I was very suicidal for months as we were dealing with this. So we actually called a family member, and we went over and took all of the guns out of the house, and they still have them 2 years later, because I think that more than anything, the longest lingering issue I'm going to have to work out with from this experience is how comfortable I am with my own death.
But going back to, so we went to the doctor, and Scott was getting Prozac to help him deal with the highs and lows.
Yeah, so we talked to our bishop, and I was Elders Quorum president at the time, and I resigned as Elders Quorum president and said, I can't do this anymore. I am suicidal, and I just need to take some time off to sort this out. And he recommended a therapist, and so we started seeing him, and he prescribed Prozac, which I still take. So I've been on for about 2 years now.
And I also got in and got a blood test to see if there's anything wrong with me physically with my testosterone levels, and they didn't find anything wrong. But then a year later, I went back for a physical, and she was asking me about my sex drive, and I told her it was the same. And she said, well, let's take another test. And so they took a test, and they said it's normal. And then a week later, they called back and said, no, it's not normal. And actually, my testosterone level is like barely on the charts. And I guess they'd missed it the year before. My testosterone was low the year before, and I'm so frustrated, because that's the whole reason that I went in to see them, was because of my low sex drive, and they missed that my testosterone was really low. I finally started doing testosterone cream, and that helped a lot. So it's just like, between testosterone cream and the vibrator and the erotica, I think I have orgasms now, but I'm not even positive, because what I read doesn't seem the same, but I'm enjoying sex a lot more, and I'm responding, mm-hmm. and I never have before.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her body's actually reacting in ways that, you know, you would imagine of someone who is having a good experience, you know, and is actually feeling something through that which she never had before. So that's very exciting.
Well, I think that's really phenomenal. How long have you been experiencing kind of this shift in your ability to find pleasure in sex?
Oh gosh, 6 months.
Yeah, so you're just starting.
I mean, it's been better for a while.
Yeah,
but I just started testosterone cream like a few months ago.
Okay,
that's true. So yeah. I think we'd had a couple of like little blips here and there, like in the last year and a half. But once the testosterone cream came on and was worked in, it's become much more consistent and reliable. Which, you know, I mean, before that was almost even worse because it's like sometimes it would happen and then sometimes nothing. More of that unpredictability and that frustration and disappointment. And so progress was being made, and then the getting the testosterone cream has really helped it be a lot more consistent. Another really ironic thing is, so the Prozac kind of has really suppressed my sex drive. One of the side effects of a lot of antidepressants is difficulty achieving orgasm, and that has definitely been true for me. And so we actually, sadly, kind of have sex less often now that we're we've both kind of worked through so much of this stuff, and you know, about our sex life, and now we kind of have the lowest
we have lower frequency, but it is better.
Yeah, it is so better, but better. It is much lower frequency, and that's a lot of things. I mean, our children are all ages that where it's just really exhausting, and I start a new job, and plus we're dealing with all of this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, I had a faith crisis through this, so I mean, yeah, we just have a lot faith crisis. Going
and
on.
So at night, when we finally get to bed, we are both just exhausted, and we both talk about, it's just like, hey, we should have sex sometime soon. It's like, yeah, let's do that, and then we go to sleep, you know? and we have to really kind of make an effort to make it happen. But yeah, but it's a lot better than it ever has been before. It's so much more complex than we are adequately prepared to deal with, I think, and not just in the church, you know, in the broader culture as well. And I really think that, you know, these podcasts and other resources that are getting out there are going to go such a long way towards helping people cut down on all the time that it takes and the pain that people have to go through to get to a place to where they have a good sex life with their spouse, who they love and who they want, the only person they want to have a good sex life with. You know, and it seems like it should just come naturally and be easy, and it's so much more complicated than we think it is. And I'm just so glad that we've had as many resources as we've had, and hope that future generations will have more resources than we did, so everyone can just have a better experience and have better marriages. Having a better sex life makes for a lot better marriage, and I think everyone can get on board with that, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so just a few thoughts that I'll go back on that I was having as you were both talking, going back to kind of some of the messaging maybe that you were having to deal with, Mitzi, as he was disclosing pornography use to you. A lot of the things I hear from women that I work with is, one is, now I feel like I'm competing with the porn. Another message is, you're going to want to do what you see in the porn with me. And that seems unacceptable. Or you're going to be thinking about the porn star and just using my body to get off on but you're really going to be fantasizing about somebody other than me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that feels very threatening. Anyway, those are just some of the things that come to mind that I think is hard for women in particular to reframe, given the strong messaging we've been given that we're supposed to be the end-all be-all for the sexual arousal of our spouses.
Right. Well, and I think that that's where differentiation helps a lot. I mean, I just think that we're sexual beings and we bring our own sexuality to the plate and we aren't tied together. Like, I think that's what we think. We're going to get married and we're going to become sexual together and it's only going to be about us. And it's like, yeah, and that's like, not the way
there's,
that it
there's
is.
Not going to be Scott's sexuality and Mitzi's sexuality.
Let's
there's going
bring
to
it
be
together.
Our sexuality and that's it. And that's not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I just think of porn as kind of like junk food. It's just like, yeah, you can have a really wonderful sex life, and that can be really nourishing and filling. But sometimes you just want junk food, and that's just how I frame porn. I just don't think about what it means about me or what it means about our marriage. Like, I just don't think about it that way. I just feel like that's a waste of my time. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like it's about me anyway, because Scott had a porn problem for 10 years before he met me. You know, I just feel like it's just outside of me. So I just don't take that. I don't take that on. I don't own
that. The only thing that is supported by research of what I said is that people that do watch porn tend to mimic what they see in porn as far as the the nonviolent porn. Okay, that's right. Not the case actually for violence. But, you know, if you see oral sex for the first time in a pornography viewing, you're like, huh, you know, maybe it could be that. Or so it does increase the likelihood that your sex life will become more varied, which is actually a positive thing. It's not a negative thing.
I think that's the thing. I think we just have to think about porn differently. Seriously, that's right.
Yeah, and if I could make a comment on that, I wrote this down actually, because one of the big fears when you find out that pornography is a part of the relationship like that it's like, oh, like you said, oh, you're going to want to do all this stuff, and oh, you're going to be thinking about the porn stars and stuff, and oh, I have to compete, and they're more attractive, and I can never look like that, and I can never be as sexual as they are and stuff like that. And I think a lot of that is based on our messaging and on our model. And unfortunately, I don't think it's really reflective of reality. But I remember one of the first lectures I had in my Psych 101 class was perception versus reality. And perception is extremely powerful, and a lot of times it trumps reality. I have to put that caveat in there, but I mean,
podcast has been about perception.
Yeah.
trumping reality.
Yeah.
Your whole story is about that. Yeah.
I can remember a couple of times when I tried to do like porno things with, you know, in the bedroom with Mitzi that she, I could tell was not really comfortable with. It's kind of like after the fact, I felt really badly, and I felt really like I had been selfish, and I had kind of, objectified her and kind of taken advantage of our relationship and stuff for pretty selfish reasons. But there are probably two instances over 10 years that I can think of like that. What I can think of a lot more examples of is when we would just have kind of resentful sex, like where I would feel like, okay, if we don't have sex, I'm going to slip up or something like that. And so you have to have sex with me. Even if you're feeling sick or tired or not in the mood, well, you're never in the mood. So we won't even consider that, you know, and really taking advantage of her position of being so accommodating, and just kind of thinking, okay, well, if you're not going to get yours, then at least I'm going to get mine, you know, and this is, and if you just want to be the accommodating wife, who gives me sex whenever I want, then I'm just going to have sex with you whenever I want. And that'll be our relationship. There were a lot more times when we had sexual experiences where I felt very badly after the fact. Actually, I should correct that. I didn't feel badly at the time. I feel badly about it now. At the time, I felt entitled, and I felt like this was the lesser of two evils, that, you know, requiring kind of or importuning my wife to have sex with me, even though she, you know, was not feeling well or whatever, was the lesser of two evils if it kept me from backsliding or something like that. And that happened all the time. And so, you know, when you compare and you look at, you know, oh, porn is going to do this to your marriage, and it's going to make your husband this uncaring person who objectifies you and takes advantage of you. I'm like, porn didn't do that to me in any degree compared to what my model of trying to regulate my sexuality to fit within the prescribed
righteous sex
model, righteous model, mm-hmm. did. Like, that created a lot more unhealthy and disrespectful and discourteous sexual encounters than porn ever did.
Well, it goes back to this model again that we have in Mormon sexuality, not just Mormon sexuality, but definitely in Mormon sexuality, that your sexuality is really your partner's.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your own to explore. You know,
or it's the relationships. It belongs to the relationship.
Right.
And it can't be expressed without both people being involved, even if one of them, is feeling sick or is not interested or whatever. It's like, too bad you signed up for this.
Libido differences are probably the most common issue amongst couples. This puts a lot of pressure on both the high libido and the low libido partner to constantly be at odds with one another. Again, be pressured by each other, and also either play the I'm going to blame you or I'm going to blame me game, because one of us must be broken since we're not 100% in sync with each other all the time.
Yeah.
And that's a very harmful way to look at sexuality. Instead of having more the context of, my sexuality is mine, I get to figure it out, I get to develop it, I get to decide who I want to share it with, when and how and in what ways, and how we're going to contract that as a couple and negotiate that. That's a very different model.
Yeah.
A better model.
Yeah, I like that model a lot more.
Yeah. Well, I want to just give you a shout out for getting rid of the guns. I think that's very good practice when there's somebody who's struggling with suicide in the home. I think that's something to be very aware of. So I'm glad you brought that up. And I also haven't heard necessarily whether or not you ever got professional help for some of these things. Like, did you ever consider going to see a sex therapist or somebody who might be able to help you with some of the struggles that you were experiencing?
No, I mean, we just read like a lot of books, Dr. Snarch's Passionate Marriage, and read the book Mating in Captivity. And
yeah, Esther Perel.
I took Jennifer Fife's The Art of Desire class. So we just did a lot of resources, but not actual professional. The only professional therapy we had was with Scott's Suicidality.
Yeah. And Mitzi actually went in and met together with him a couple times, and then she went in once by herself.
Yeah, I went in once, and it was actually really helpful. It was like towards the beginning, and he's a former LDS bishop, this therapist was, and I was crying about the porn with him, and he was like, do you think that Scott's lying about it? Do you think he's not in control? And I said, no. And he said, okay. And I was like, okay, you know, and just to hear someone, especially, you know, with a high position, former position in the church, to kind of be like, way gray about it was so helpful to me because no one in my life is gray.
Well, yeah, and just be kind of more objective about it. Like, so is this causing problems in your right. relationship and in your marriage? Like, is he out of control with this? And is that like, no? It's like,
yeah.
And just and kind why? Of that pregnant why? Pause after yeah. like, so let's think about this for a minute. Why are you so upset? And it's really because you're supposed to be, because yeah. everyone tells you you're supposed to be.
It's hard to get out of that space.
Yeah, regardless of what's actually happening. And I should clarify, quick. I know that a lot of people can have very unhealthy relationships with pornography and can be really, you know,
crappy to their wives.
Really crappy to their wives and things like that. So I don't want to say that yeah, my experience is going to be like everyone else's. I'm just trying
to speak for myself with this mm-hmm. too. I don't want to speak for anyone in their relationships with their husbands or with porn or with anything. I'm yeah, speaking for only for ourselves. But I during this time I did have to pause and just think and just say I had to stop thinking about what porn was supposed to be doing to my marriage and to Scott and see things as they actually were. And what was supposed to happen and what was actually happening were very different.
Mm-hmm.
So I just had to see reality and perceptions that were actual
mm-hmm.
in my life.
Yeah. And I started making a lot of jokes about the slippery slope because Mormons love a good slippery slope and we can make a slippery slope out of just about anything. That's the Ted Bundy argument, you know, is the slippery slope. And he's like, well, you know, because if someone looks at porn, then they have to look at more extreme porn to get the same high. And then just looking isn't enough. And then they have to start acting it out. And then next thing you know, they're on death row because they've murdered a bunch of people. And it's like, it's a slippery slope. But that's not a causal chain that's going to happen in every case or even most cases. You know, I just started talking about, you know, making fun of slippery slopes every chance I could because they're used as such a scare tactic to keep people from doing things. And then when someone does something, you already know the slippery slope that they're on and where it's going to lead. And so you don't even stop to look at like, okay, what's actually happening and where is Scott on this slippery slope now that he's been on it for 20 years and I'm just hearing about it. You know, it's like, If he was on a slippery slope, he would probably be at the bottom by now. And if this is the bottom of the slippery slope and there's not really a lot going on, like, why am I so worried?
Okay, so we've kind of reached the end of what we wanted to cover as far as dealing with the marriage portion of your relationship and timeline. So I'd like to just give you both a chance to maybe give some closing thoughts as far as how this affected your marriage, both negatively or positively, just kind of an overview of what you feel has opened up for you maybe in this growth and stretching process that you've been through.
Well, I'll just say, you know, as I was struggling with Scott and the disclosure about the porn, and I was just praying so much because I didn't feel like there was anyone that I could talk to about it. And so I just prayed and prayed and prayed. And at a certain point, I just decided, you know, I was just going to let go of what it meant to have a porn relationship or whatever. And I was just going to leave the judgment to God. And I was going to stop putting it on myself. And I was going to stop worrying about what it meant for our marriage and what it meant for me and for him. And I was just going to give it to God and just say, this is what Scott's been dealing with. God understands this situation perfectly. And this is what Scott thinks is the best for him. And I could see the fruits of it were good for us and our marriage too. And I just left the judgment to God. And part of that too, I just feel like I just really learned how to love him unconditionally, which I just had not done. I had not been trained. I don't feel like to learn how to love unconditionally at all. And so through this process, it was just so painful, but I just fell like so much more in love with Scott, just completely, everything, good, bad, and the ugly. And I also, I just love my kids more. I just learned how to love, and it's just kind of sad that such a painful, hard thing had to teach me how to love, but that is what I've gleaned from this.
Thank you, Mitzi.
Yeah, and to kind of piggyback on that, in the book Passionate Marriage, he says, having a passionate marriage is not for the faint of heart, which is why so few couples ever achieve one. We now have a lot of firsthand experience at why that is, because, yeah, it's incredibly difficult and incredibly painful, because you have to really look at yourself, and you have to separate yourself and your beliefs and your values from everything you've gotten from the outside, and decide what's right for you and for your marriage and for your family. And yeah, and risk choosing a path that no one is going to support you on. In doing that, yeah, it's like we're not following the model, and we do not have a lot of support for the way we are handling this, and being okay with that, saying that's okay because I'm the one that has to live my life. And we are the ones that are living with our marriage, and this works for us, and we are happier, and we are more in love with each other. And yeah, I think when this happened and we had to strip away all of those conditions that we had been told were necessary to have a successful Mormon marriage, and all of a sudden those were gone, what was left? And we had to look and decide if what was left was worth holding on to. And to, I think, you know, I can speak for both of us and say that to our great surprise and pleasant surprise, there's a lot of value that was left to hold on to. There were a lot of things we had lost sight of and lost track of because we were so focused on the conditions that everyone was telling us were important. And once those were gone, we could really see each other for the people that we fell in love with. And the way that's kind of manifest is we hug more. And we hug longer, and our hugs feel different than they did before. We just look at each other differently, and our relationship has become so much more honest and so much more intimate. And that's what I wanted all along. I just had no idea it was going to be so hard and so painful to get here. But I'm so glad that we have, because this is the marriage that I've always wanted. And I'm so glad that I've found it with the person I married, because that's who I always wanted it with. We are happier together than we've ever been. And that is just worth so much. Just have to say, I'm so grateful to Mitzi for coming on and doing this as well. Because yeah, I think that, it would be very easy to dismiss a, porn user getting on and talking about how, you know, we shouldn't take porn so seriously and all these different things. And And it would be really easy to say, yeah, but what does your wife think? And I'm so glad that she has come on to share her side of things, because I think there are a lot of couples out there who will hopefully be able to discover each other again and fall in love with each other again, for the people that they really are. And that's my hope.
Well, thank you both. I think that you're really describing what maybe I mentioned at the very beginning, which is moving away from that protection model marriage to the intimacy model, which means you really have to show up, and it's not just with your best side. You know, you really have to be naked, which is in essence the symbolism of marriage, is to be naked in front of each other. And having that be an emotional nudity and an intellectual nudity and a physical nudity. And I think that's a beautiful visualization of what's happening. And that nakedness hurts sometimes, because there's parts that are hard to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also beautiful and empowering.
Yeah, I really like that.
And lovely. Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you so much for your time tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
We took the long road home, turned minutes into miles. And as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary truth.
It's been a long road here, a trail with tears, pain and sorrow too. But through every storm we traveled on, like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came back home. Was as simple as I love you, ordinary, extraordinary
truth. Some people say love is blind and forever is too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise. Can't imagine life alone. Until we're gone, watch it by my side till the day I die and into the beyond. It's as simple as our love is, That's how I wanna go. All wrapped up in the arms of our extraordinary, it's nothing ordinary love. Ordinary. No, it's extraordinary.